I'm not going to take any comments about any changes or differences at this point, but Forest Home has been a special place. It was up here during some other college briefing conferences that the Lord really spoke to me to go into full-time ministry, and have kept on in that direction, either in the local church or teaching at Talbot. And basically what I do now is direct our counseling center in Santa Ana, where we have 14 other Christian therapists, and we see between 300 and 325 people a week there at the counseling center, 95% of whom are born-again Christians from evangelical churches who are struggling with some of the difficult issues of life, struggling with some of the unresolved issues of their past. And the fortunate thing is that people who are Christians are now more apt to do something about it. The tragedy is that so many of us, some of these issues would not have to be a part of our life if we had come to grips with them much earlier. That is why I really enjoy so much doing premarital counseling, where I can take a couple for 6 to 8 hours prior to the marriage and have them put in between 40 to 50 hours of homework on the outside and really build a stable base for the marriage relationship, or make a decision not to marry, because it's far less painful to make the decision not to marry beforehand than to terminate later on. And sometimes we have as many as a third of our couples make a decision not to get married. And that, to us, is just confirmation that we are doing our job. Something about Bob Craney, I don't know if he left or not already, but we like to pick on Bob. Of course, he gives us plenty to pick on from time to time. But just recently, Chuck Swindoll wasn't in his pulpit. In fact, it was a week ago Sunday, so they asked Bob Craney to come down and to fill in. And Bob likes modern versions of the Bible, and so he used one of them to read from the pulpit, and I just like to show you what happened, and this is the way it went. The Lord is my therapist, I shall not experience negative feedback. He maketh me to mellow out in green pastures. He leadeth me beside pure waters. He gives me permission to get in touch with my feelings. He leadeth me in the paths of positive self-image. Yea, though I walk through the valley of bad vibes, I won't get uptight. I hate these modern translations. Well, there's a number of topics that I'd like us to work on together, and also to let you know that you will be asked to take notes, and you will be asked to do some thinking and to interact with other people around you, because having taught for so long, I'm sort of used to a classroom type of an environment where I expect people to learn and to grow and to change, and so I will sort of put that on you as well. And as we begin, one of the concepts that I really wanted us to consider today was the fact that as you and I go through life, life is really a journey. And within the journey of life, there are many other types of journeys that we become involved with. For example, marriage, for those of you who are married, it too is a journey. And I thought what I'd like to do this morning to begin with is just to share sort of a story with you. And to do this, I'd like you just to close your eyes and to relax right where you're seated. Since it's not afternoon or evening, I don't have to be concerned or worried about you falling asleep. But I'd like you just to tune in to this particular story. I'd like to use an environment that happens to be one of my favorites, the Grand Teton National Park, where we spend quite a bit of time. And just like you to listen and perhaps listen to some of the outside sounds of the forest here as we think about marriage. Before you begin any journey, you must select a path. One path out of many possible paths. And you don't always know the terrain that you will cover until you start. Unlike the average high country hiker, a person starting out on the marriage path can't pore over a Forest Service map or interrogate a ranger about the trail ahead. Neither does he have the advantage of trailside signs telling him in advance the exact distance or whether the trail is classified as easy, moderate, or difficult. Picture a hiker standing at the base of a mountain. He must select a path, and not one of the paths is completely level. Not one of them is an easy downhill glide. Each of them would involve work, energy, patience, endurance, and a steady pace. As he steps onto a trail and begins the gradual ascent, the hiker has time to note and delight in his surroundings. He's fresh and rested. He sets a moderate pace. Having made adequate physical preparation, he does not feel winded or weary. He takes in the sounds of the wildlife and the wind in the trees. His sense of smell awakens to the aroma of forest and flower. His eyes cradle scenes of vivid paintbrush and columbine, aspen bark and budding pine cone, stationary chipmunks on rocks and stumps, and the ever-alert hawks gliding silently overhead. By stopping occasionally, the hiker is able to fully enjoy the experience and not exhaust himself. He conserves his energy and renews his strength. Think of your marriage as a journey similar to that of a hiker. Has it been like the experience just described? Or has it seemed like such a frantic race to get somewhere that you've missed too much along the way? Have you paused now and then to get your bearings, check your directions, and renew your strength? Have you sufficiently planned for your marriage as the hiker planned for his journey? By evaluating and clarifying your expectations and determining what you were bringing to your marriage that would help it succeed? Did you, as a hiker must, select goals for your marriage and determine when to reach those goals? Where is your marriage going? Where do you want it to go? You can open your eyes. And I guess one of the questions that I want us to consider today is this: what determines the direction and the flow of your marriage? And one of the concepts I'd like us to think about is the fact that one of the main factors that is going to affect the path of our life as well as the path of our marriage is our attitude, the mindset that we have inside of our head. And one of the questions to think about is our attitude positive or is it negative? And one of the ways to analyze this is to consider some other questions. For example, in the context of the family, do we give our family members the benefit of a doubt? In the Amplified Translation of 1 Corinthians 13, one of the ways that it says that we love another person is that love gives another person the benefit of a doubt. It sees them as having the positive potential to do things and to grow and to change. And you know, very easily, this comes about in the family where we see somebody failing and then we start making statements to them like, well, I know you won't want to do this, but... And it's like we set them up ahead of time. Or I'm sure you won't be able to finish this, but I'm going to ask you to try it anyway. I listened to a man about 2 weeks ago just literally cry out in frustration because he said that for the last 10 years, practically every time his wife said something to him, it was prefaced with a statement, well, you probably won't follow through with this. And his comment was, I don't follow through because people don't believe that I will, so why should I try anymore? And they are at such a deadlock, it's going to take a box of dynamite to blast this conflict apart. Do you believe that others in your family have the capability of changing, and that you have the capability of changing, or is your hope frozen? We as believers are called upon to be people who have hope, who believe in the possibility of change. A woman just recently came in to see me and she said, I don't think anything can happen to my marriage. I think we're just stuck in this. And she talked, and we just started talking back with her and offering some suggestions. And as she walked out of the office, she said, you know, maybe there is hope. Maybe something can occur. And that's what we want to instill within our family members, that it is possible for all of us to change and to grow. And when we think about attitude, there's another phrase that I'd like to just share with you that reflects the concept of attitude. It's a word called, or two words called, self-talk. All of you here today, you talk to yourselves. And it doesn't mean that your elevator doesn't go to the top floor either. It doesn't mean that you're on the verge of the funny farm. We all carry on inner conversations inside of our mind all day long. And the content of those inner conversations is going to have a lot to do with what you say in your outer conversation. And this is one of the mistakes that many of us have made for many years that work in the area of communication. We've focused too much on what people say outwardly without getting back to the source of it. And when you can begin to really analyze what you're saying to yourself, that's going to explain a number of your responses to other individuals. Your inner conversations are crucial. About a year and a half ago, a friend of mine wrote a book on this, and he entitled it, Do You Hear What You're Thinking? Very apropos title. And I'd like to just give you an example or an illustration of what has happened in a lot of marriages with the self-talk. And we're going to look in on a couple on a Saturday morning, and I'll just show you what's going on, and then we'll trace how it got to this place. The husband is asleep, and the wife is saying, 9:15, I don't believe it. He's sleeping away the morning. How insensitive. I had to go in there and wake him up. Well, see, she got up about 7 o'clock that morning, and here's what happened, and then I'll show you the outcome of this. She's carrying on a conversation with herself, and before I show you this, let me just mention that it doesn't matter whether we're a man or a woman. We all talk to ourselves. 7:30. Boy, I hope he gets up pretty soon. I'd like to get started on these projects. With the kids away today, we can get a lot done. 8:15. Boy, I don't hear a sound. Well, I'm going to start work in the yard. He'll probably hear me, and then he can join me. And then we come back to 9:15. What time is it? I can't believe it. He's sleeping away the morning. Who does he think he is? How insensitive. I had to go in there and wake him up. 10 o'clock. Just because he has no work at the plant or at church, he thinks he's entitled to sack out. What about me? Boy, is he going to hear from me. I'll let him sleep, but he's going to pay a price for it. 10:45. And I was going to cook his favorite meal and dessert tonight. Fat chance of that. How could he be so insensitive? Look at all I do for him. 11 o'clock. He gets up. He might feel he shouldn't have gotten up. It's about time you got up. It looks like you were going to waste the entire day. Husband, looking a bit startled. What's with you? I'm just taking my time getting up and enjoying a day off. That's just it. You're around here so rarely and half the day is shot. By the time you get dressed and cleaned up, lunch will be over and nothing has been accomplished. Who said I was getting dressed and cleaned up? The guy's got to have a death wish. The only thing I want to accomplish is a cup of coffee, the paper, and the football game on TV. What? The whole day is shot. I don't get a day off. There's a whole list of work to be done here. When are you going to do it? Do what? I suppose you've been saving up a list of work projects again. Why don't you give me some notice ahead of time? If I wanted to work today, I could go into the shop and get overtime plus some peace and quiet. I guess you can finish out the rest of the day. You know how that developed. In this situation, as in most situations, you and I have a choice of what we say to ourselves. It didn't have to go this way. Let me show you another possibility. I wish he'd get up. I think I'll check and see if he's resting or sleeping. A little later on. Well, I'm not sure he's going to get up in time to do much today. I'd better revise my list and then ask him if he could help me with those two chores after lunch. Third response. I'm a bit upset with him, but I have to admit I didn't tell him I wanted him to work today. Next time, I'll talk it over with him before the weekend. And then the final, the clincher. I could serve him breakfast in bed when he wakes up. That'll knock his socks off. When's the last time I've done that? Two choices. We can go ahead and we can keep complaining in our mind about what's going on about the other person, or we can take a more positive posture. Now, this is one situation, and I'm sure most of us have gotten caught in that from time to time. But what if you're the type of an individual where your self-talk is negative most of the time? People then in the family don't have a chance to improve or to change because we see them through a veil of failure. In fact, if somebody starts to change, we're suspicious of it. It'll never last. They're doing it just because they want something. I'd like to show you another possibility. of the choice that we have in terms of attitude and energy that we have for our marriage and our family life. Here is a description of a marriage relationship. Down here you have the amount of energy available for the marriage. And in this particular diagram, we can see that most of the energy of the marriage is being channeled toward what we see as the problems of the marriage, the conflicts of the marriage, or even the defects of the other person. And what we're doing is that we're maybe saving 20 or 25% of the energy available to the marriage for the continuing nurturing of the positive aspects of the marriage relationship. And what's fascinating here is that what we have done, we've developed a tunnel vision. We're focusing just on one small area of the marriage and forgetting the fact that over here we have all these positives. This reminds me so much of so many couples that I see where they will come in and they sit down and they say, "Norm, we can't wait to tell you about all the problems in our marriage relationship." And quite often I frustrate them because I say, "I'd like each of you to give me a 3-minute summary of what you feel about the marriage, and then I have a couple of questions." And in 3 minutes they try to get it all in, and then I start asking, "Tell me about some of the things that you appreciate about your spouse. And I'd like you to give me a listing of some of the positive aspects of the marriage relationship." And I have seen couples 45 minutes later walk out saying, "I can't believe it. About 80% of our marriage is going so well, and we've ignored that and neglected it. And all we were doing was focusing just on the problems." And part of the difficulty is that we attack problems quite often with an ineffective approach. It doesn't bring about the desired change. It tends to reinforce the basic problem that we see there. In fact, here's what occurs. When you give less attention to a positive area of a marriage relationship, it actually weakens it, because anything that is positive needs reinforcement, it needs nurturing, and by paying attention to the negative, especially in an ineffective way, it's going to actually expand it. And one of the principles I learned about 25 years ago from one of the textbooks that I read was simply this: when you pay attention to another person's mistakes, you reinforce them. There is a greater likelihood to bring them about. In just a minute, I want to show you a model that can actually change this about. So instead of what I have just shown you, what I'd like to suggest to us for both our marriages and the totality of our family life is that we do the following. We take the bulk of the energy that we have available for the family life or for the marriage, and we use it to enhance, to upgrade, to nurture, and to strengthen those positive areas that are already there. And then take a smaller amount of energy in a positive way to look at the problem areas or the negatives that are there in the marriage. Now, if we're honest, all of us will have to admit, yes, there are times when we have complaints. We would like to see a change in our child. We would like to see a change in our spouse. But do we express it in such a way that the other person is willing to hear it and to consider it? Quite often, we don't. And I'd like to show you a typical way that people use to express the complaints and then reverse it to a way where people will be willing to listen. Sort of goes like this. Most complaints are general and negative. "You're never affectionate. You're so inconsiderate." Now, if somebody were to say that to you, what kind of feelings would you have inside? What would be going on? Not true. Anger. We'd probably defend it. "I am too affectionate. I held your hand 6 weeks ago. In fact, I put it on the calendar." And we tune out to all the rest of the time where we didn't do it. Okay, many of us get caught up in this. We attack the person. We want to change him, and so we come on and we say, "This is what you're doing wrong. I don't like this and this and this." But the other person does not want to admit that they're wrong. None of us likes to admit, basically, that we're wrong. So to gain a hearing and a receptive listener, we do the following. First of all, make it specific. You say, I don't know what you mean when you tell me that I'm inconsiderate. But if I say, you rarely pay me a compliment, and you don't acknowledge my efforts to keep the house neat and fix dinners you like, then you will know what it is that bothers me. The problem is, you're still going to feel like you've been attacked. And so if I can do one very simple thing, I think you might listen. If I can point toward the desired behavior, you're more likely to respond. And what I mean is this. I'd appreciate it if you'd ask how my day was. I'd like you to let me know if you liked the dinner. I'd like you to pay me compliments. If I point toward what I want, you're more likely to consider that. I'll never forget a janitor in a Presbyterian church that I talked to about 17 years ago. He and his wife had raised three daughters. Typical kids, he said. They had their up times, they had their down times, and when they did something wrong, he said, we asked them two questions. We never went over a lot of what they did wrong because they knew what they did wrong. We knew what they did wrong. We said, why do you think that happened? And then secondly, what will you do the next time? We always pointed them toward the future. Do we live more in the past with the people that we live with? Or are we standing by them, encouraging them to move on to the future, saying, I believe that you can do it differently. Here's what I'd like. Point toward the desired behavior. Now, I borrowed this model. A lot of what I have, I borrow. I read incessantly, and people are able to say things a lot better than I am, so I will use it and integrate it. And I have shared this with I don't know how many people, and for those who have taken this and used this model, they have actually changed around behavior in two or three days with some of the kids or within the marriage relationship. But let me also mention something to you seated here this morning. Chances are, most of you will go out of here and continue to make complaints in the very same way that you've been making them. Now, that doesn't sound like I believe in your potential for change. I do, but I say it in that way because we are such creatures of habit that we can have the proper desire and the proper goals, but we're going to revert back to the old style unless you do the following. If you would like to change your response to somebody else, write down the old way that you've been responding and then rewrite it in this new way and read it over every morning for about a month, and it will begin to lock into you. We are such creatures of habit that if you have one new positive behavior that you want to make a part of your life, it'll take you a minimum of 18 repetitions before it has a chance to lock in. Many people come back and say, gee, Norm, I tried that 3 times or 4 times or 5 times and nothing happened. But we didn't give it a chance. In Philippians chapter 4, verse 9, when Paul was talking about what to do about our thought life, he said, practice these things I've said unto you and model your way of living upon them. Practice is repetitive behavior over and over and over again. Write out what you've been doing, rewrite it in this new way, and then practice it and rehearse it. And you might find a difference. Now, in talking about concentrating on the positive, I'm going to ask all of you to write something out at this particular time. So if you need a pen or a pencil, borrow one from somebody right around you. But I do have a writing assignment that I'm going to ask you to respond to at this moment. And here is what I would like you to do. I would like you to write down two specific things that you really appreciate about either your spouse, or if you're not here with a spouse, another family member. Write down two specific things that you really appreciate about your spouse or another family member, and I'll give you time to do that. Two questions. Two questions about this. And you can just answer this in your mind. When was the last time you shared what it is that you appreciated with this other person? And secondly, when was the last time you can remember hearing an appreciation given to you? Sometimes in marriages, the problem is we begin to take other people for granted. And there is a lot that you could begin looking for to let the other person know, I really appreciate you. For example, a lot of wives have said to me, you know, Norm, the only time I ever hear anything about the ironing or the washing is that one day out of 30 when the socks are not there or the favorite shirt is not there. The other 29 days out of 30, everything is perfect, and it's that one time. And whenever I hear that, I feel convicted because I have been guilty of that as well. Why not go out of our way to let the other person know, boy, I really appreciate this. It'll make a difference. One of the concepts that I want to start talking about today, and will take me a couple days to work through, is the idea of marriage is a gift. Giving a gift can be a delightful experience. I enjoy creating surprises. Fortunately, my wife enjoys getting surprises, so that really works out. But I don't know if you can think back to a time of a special Christmas or a birthday when you received a gift, and probably that person that purchased the gift for you spent some time thinking about, boy, what is it that's going to bring a sense of delight and fulfillment and enjoyment into the life of that other person? What kind of a gift would just make their day and just really ring the bell for them? And that's one of the fun things of thinking about a gift, is doing some searching. Sometimes we see, oh boy, here's another birthday or Christmas. Here's a chore. What am I going to go ahead and give to the other person? But again, it goes back to attitude. And if we say, what is it that this person is not going to expect and that's really going to fill a need in their life? And you go ahead and you do this, and when you give it to the person, all of a sudden you see this expression of joy and surprise and delight on their face, and it just makes a difference. And I know as kids, we'd take much more time with gifts, and we'd play with them, and we'd show it to others, and we would use them. Well, had you ever considered the fact that when you got married, you became a gift to your spouse? In fact, you might be the best gift that your spouse ever received. And when I think of myself as a gift to my wife, then I have to ask myself the question, am I bringing a greater amount of joy and delight into that other person's life because I'm a gift? Am I making their life better and more fulfilling than before we got married? What kind of a gift am I? And on the other hand, my wife is a gift to me. How do I then treat that gift? Do you treat your spouse as though he or she were one of the most precious commodities of your life? Where you cherish that gift, where you protect that gift, where in actuality you do all that you can to make life better for that gift instead of making it harder. I received a very special gift about 2 months ago. This really came out of the blue, too. About 6 months ago, I got a letter from a seminary, Western Conservative Baptist Seminary in Portland, and they were giving me an honorary doctorate, which just about floored me. It's one of the few times in my life where I've been silent when I read a letter. So we went up there for the ceremony and everything. It was just a delightful experience, but they had gotten the names and addresses of about 150 of my friends and relatives and written them a letter and asked them to write back a congratulatory letter. And so what they gave me was this binder with about 60 letters in it from people that I've been with or have been relatives or friends all these years. And they're in cellophane with an acetate over every one. And I just sat there and I read those letters. And, you know, you almost handled it like it was something precious. That first thing I did, my compulsiveness, I Xeroxed a copy of every letter, and I have got a Xerox copy in the bank box. It means that much. And it's put out in a special place. Do we treat one another in marriage with that same respect? It's just something for us to consider. And since marriage is a gift, there are a lot of continuing gifts that we can give to one another in our marriage relationship or in our family life, and I'd like to talk about five or six of those over the next 2 days. And I think one of the neatest gifts that you and I can give within the context of a family is the gift of encouragement. The gift of encouraging another individual. I'd like to read a couple of passages to you along this line. One of them is actually dealing with discouragement. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 21, and I'm reading this from the Amplified, this is what it says. Fathers, do not provoke or irritate or fret your children. Do not be hard on them or harass them, lest they become discouraged and sullen and feel inferior and frustrated. Do not break their spirit. And the Scripture, the Word of God, is admonishing us not to be overly hard on another person so that we take away the spark in their life. But then, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 11, we read, therefore, encourage one another and build each other up, just as, in fact, you are doing. Now, the word encourage literally means to give courage to. To give courage to. One of the delights of watching the Olympics was to see how other athletes and coaches and friends encouraged one another. In the finals of the diving, where the young man, I think his last name was Kimball, who'd been in an automobile accident in 1981 and had facial surgery and leg surgery, whenever he hit his dive, to see his dad over on the side, who was the coach, just jumping up and down and just going over and praising him and encouraging him. And I'm sure that he encouraged him during the difficult times as well. And to see the courage of some of those athletes, frankly, for me, the most thrilling sight of all the Olympics were the wheelchair races of the handicapped people on Saturday, where they were out there on the Coliseum track clipping along at a 4-minute mile. People who could not walk. People who probably experienced many others saying to them, give up all idea of athletics. Forget it. You're a cripple now. But I'm sure there were other people saying, well, go ahead and try it. You can do it. Give it your best shot. And the inspiration of those people who can never stand up like you and I, out there just having a time of their life and encouraging one another. I like the concept that Joyce Landorf has in one of her books, where she talks about both balcony people and basement people. In our lives, there are some people who we term basement people. They can be friends, even our close family members, or even parents. And they are individuals who live in these dark, damp basements. And when we walk along next to that basement or next to where they are, they just sort of reach up and try to grab us and drag us back into the basement, because they're the people that say, forget it, you can't do it. You're going to be a loss most of your life anyway. Give up on that. But there are other individuals who are what we call balcony people. And these are the people who are leaning out of the balcony, looking at you and saying, go for it. You can do it. Give it a try. I'm for you. They are our cheering section. I think that we are called upon within the context of a family to be a cheering section for other family members, to bolster them by our belief. 4 questions that I'd like you to write down and answer later on that deals with this. The questions are these. Who are the basement people in your life? Who are the basement people in your life? The second question, who are the balcony people in your life? Who are the ones that cheer you on? Third question, who might you be a basement person toward? Who might you be a basement person toward? Could it be a child, a spouse, a brother, a sister? And then finally, who might you be a balcony person toward? You believe in them. You cheer them on. You know, there are many ways to encourage other people. Sometimes a husband or a wife will just call the other individual during the middle of the day to just say, you know, I was thinking about you, and I knew you had a lot of work to do today, and I just wanted to let you know that I was praying for you today. Or couples, before they leave in the morning, will say to one another, you know, why don't we see what it is that we can pray for in one another's life today? Because I know both of us have a lot going on. And so they make this commitment to pray for one another. Then at the end of the day, you have something more to talk about. At 2:30, I prayed for you because I knew you were going to be in that meeting. How did it go? And to be a person who knows that other people are praying for you, what a difference that makes. I would imagine that you pray for quite a number of people, but do you let them know that you're praying for them? A gentleman came up to me last night and just said, Norm, I've been praying for you for this conference. I appreciated hearing that. One of the commitments that I've made in my own counseling practice is to pray each day by name and issue for every client that I am working with. I have a little prayer list to remind me because I have 25 clients that I'm seeing each week. And over the years, I've discovered that for some of them, the only thing that kept them going was the knowledge that one person was praying for them. And I let them know in the first or second session that this is my practice, that I pray for you, and I'd like you to let me know what it is that you want me to pray about. But when you pray for another person, give them the opportunity to pray for you. That's one of the ways that you can encourage them, is to invite them to be a part of your life in that way. Compliments are another way to encourage a person, to go out of our way to give them compliments. Charles Shedd made it a point to give his wife one compliment, at least one compliment, every day for the past 25 years of their marriage. And each week he gives her one new compliment he's never given her before. You can't imagine the number of men that have come up and said, has he ever put them in a book? Can I buy it someplace? No. We've got to think of that by ourselves. And I mean, a compliment is a genuine compliment, not a left-handed compliment like the one I'm going to show you right now. I have a favorite cartoon character, Leroy and Loretta. They're called the Lockhorns. And they were seated at dinner one night, and they had guests over for a meal, and I guess Loretta had prepared some new dish, and the people were asking, boy, where'd you get this recipe? And Leroy said, it's an old family recipe handed down by the survivors. Now, that's not the kind of compliment that we're talking about. Don't ever try that one. You know, it's really easy for us to give compliments to another person based upon what they've done. Boy, the house looks great. Or the yard looks tremendous. Or I like all the grades that you've gotten. Yeah, but what happens when you go to that other person and say, I appreciate you, and I value you just for who you are. It's not based on what you do. If you were to put your hand on the other person's shoulder and respond to them on the intangibles in their life, or just for the value of who they are, they would be shocked because we don't usually hear that. But that's a way of saying, I believe in you. I'm for you. Now, very honestly, as a parent, there are times where you and I are going to sort of get caught in a situation where we want to encourage the other person, but we got a feeling that maybe they're biting off too much and they're not going to make it, and we're trying to protect them from the discouragement. And so we waver back and forth, and Joyce and I got caught in this in the past 6 months with our daughter. Cheryl is 23. She's a full-time manicurist, has an excellent practice, and she's also involved in doing nail art. She does the miniaturized paintings on nails. She takes a brush with two little hairs, and she'll sit there and draw a flamingo or the head of a tiger. You know, I can hardly see it, and yet she's sitting there doing it, and it's perfect. And she's really gifted that way. So she's competed, and this last year she took first place in one of the nail arts. And there's another type of art competition called the three-dimensional sculpture, where there are raised figures on here. It's unbelievable. She has the head of an elephant on one with the ears up there and rice coming out as the tusk and the big trunk. She had another one which was the head of a panther with flashing green lights because of a wire coming up the model's arm to a battery. You know. And she'd never entered this. And there was a contest up at Reno with a $5,000 diamond on a necklace, which is first prize. And she said, I think I'll enter that and go up and win it. And we're saying, Cheryl, you never even tried that before. She says, well, yeah, I know that, but I think I can do it. And she worked by the hour on this, and some of them looked good. Some of them she had to refine more. And we're standing there wondering, boy, should we really encourage her to go for it? Or, you know, sometimes she gets hurt so much. She gets her hopes up, and then, boom, it doesn't come through, and she's really discouraged. And we want to somewhat protect her from that. And so we wavered back and forth, and I think, hopefully, unfortunately, it won out that we were saying, yeah, try it. Give it your best shot. Go ahead and put in all the work. And she put in about 40 hours and put it on the model's fingers, and the model couldn't even blow her nose for 2 days. I mean, she went around like this. Oh, so they went up there, and it was Sunday afternoon, we got a phone call, and Joyce came out and says, your daughter's on the phone, she wants you on the other line. And so we get on the other line and said, how you doing, Cheryl? Oh, fine. I want it. See you tonight. You know, just very casual, come off the wall, be home tonight. And she did it. And we looked back on that and said, you know, I'm glad we encouraged her to the degree we did. And maybe it's best that we don't protect our children from some of the disappointments of life. As long as we believe in them and as a person and their capability to try, because there's going to be a lot of things that we all try, and they're not going to turn out the way that we want them to turn out. All of us want to be encouraged. But I think it's very important that we let other people in our family know the best way to encourage us. And so what I'd like you to do right now is just to write down, what is one of the best ways to encourage you? A second gift that we can give to others in a family relationship, I'll just start on today because it'll take me a while to complete it, but I'd like to begin by reading several passages from the Word of God that speaks to this issue. In Psalm 34, verses about 16 through 18, it says, the Lord hears and delivers them out of their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. In Psalm 116, verses 1 through 2, I love the Lord because He hears my voice and my supplications. Because He has inclined His ear to me, therefore I shall call upon Him as long as I live. In Jeremiah 33:3, call upon me and I will answer you, and I will tell you great and mighty things which you do not know. When you hear the word hear in Scripture, it literally means to pay heed to. The literal translation is to pay heed to. We also have other passages which use the word hear as well as listen. In Proverbs 18:13, it says, he who answers a matter before he hears all the facts, to him it is folly and shame. Proverbs chapter 21, verse 11 says, the wise man learns by listening. The wise man learns by listening. In James 1:19, in your older translations, it said, be quick to hear. But in the Amplified, it says, to be a ready listener. In Jesus' name.